XTDRV, so we're able to say, but it's not a game machine, it's a real computer. Look, you know, we can change all of these things and we can evolve the operating system and make it into a real computer. So, come on, give us some more money, it'll be great, you know? And they said, no, we're not going to give you more money. You know, it's amazing, but people with millions of dollars won't give you a million. If I had a couple million, I'd give you a million if you wanted one. Come talk with me afterwards, I got some. Oh, which reminds me also, by the way, that bouncing ball was the original logo of the machine. Commodore changed it to the double check marks for some reason that I never really understood, because I think the bouncing ball is a perfectly decent logo for this machine. And it's too bad that they changed, but they didn't change it fast enough, and the first bunch of Amigas were built with the bouncing ball logos that could have been affixed to them, but didn't actually get on there. And I don't have any with me now, but later on during the show, I might happen to have one or two of those original bouncing ball things. If you would like to ask me, if you remember to ask me for one, I might have one for you. You can peel the check marks off your Amigas and stick a bouncing ball on there. Or if you have a 2000, stick a logo on it, you know? So we went back and we started working intensely to get the entire thing done and to make it, you know, the harder guys now had to take it from these breadboards to and bring it into reality, make real chips out of them. Software guys had to continue to evolve the software, and now with a mind toward making it into a real professional computer with all the capabilities that the Amiga now has, as compared with lots of capabilities but still a game machine. Although, in truth, we kept saying, well, we've got to, you know, make a real system out of it, we've got to make a real true computer system out of it, we always still wanted it to be a killer game machine. And so while we added these other layers of software on top of the core that we had originally created, we kept the core as lean and mean as possible. Dale in particular was always emphatic about wanting to keep the underlying stuff as tight and as lean as possible so that, you know, it could still do reasonably good games like, you know, Marble Madness or the Flight Simulator, which are, you know, and I don't mean to not mention the other games, it's just I'm standing up here and I got bright lights in my eyes, so those are the only two that come to mind. But, you know, there's a lot of really great arcade quality games that are on the Amiga now, and that was always our intention, to have it still do that and to have it still be able to run in a multitasking environment, although you can't be too successful playing Marble Madness and Flight Simulator at the same time, though I have tried it, you know, come on, I can do this, I know I can do this. It's great. Whatever you do, don't try to land on the aircraft carrier upside down, it doesn't work. The flight simulators are great. My favorite flight simulator story is that you can take the Flight Simulator 2 that comes from Sublogic, and it has two planes in it, a Cessna and a Learjet, and the Cessna has a ceiling of 9,000 feet or something like that, and the Learjet can go up to 30 or 40, and you can switch between planes in flight. So what you do is you fly the Learjet up to its ceiling and then turn it into a Cessna. Whoa, you've never seen a plane fly like that before. Outside loops, you know. It's great. And another thing that I really like about the flight simulator is you take the Learjet up to 30,000 feet, you do an end over and dive with your nose straight into the ground, and then dive straight into the water, and you hit the water and it says, crash, you landed without your landing gear, you know? I knew I forgot something. I'm like, oh, God. yeah. So everyone went back to work. And the hardware guys, they got their first batch of chips not too much longer. And the first batch of chips didn't work quite right. So, you know, we went through several iterations adjusting what we wanted them to do and finding some bugs. And there was one batch where, I believe it was just before the next CES, they got a batch of chips in that we wanted to show at the next CES, and it didn't work quite right. The chip didn't work the way it was supposed to. There was one trace, one little tiny electric line on the chip. You guys know how microscopic those little things are? One of them was wrong, and the chip wouldn't work correctly because of this. So what did these guys do? They rented a high-powered microscope, and they went in there with an X-Acto knife. I swear! And, you know, the X-Acto knife looks like you're going in there with a chainsaw cutting at threads. Oh, wreck that one. And they fixed four of them this way and took them to the show. It's an incredible thing. I've always had a lot of respect for hardware guys, but not like I have ever since the Amiga days. I've never seen geniuses like that at work before. They put together this. This was the so-called black box, the original Amiga computer that we put together, that we first distributed to other people, to software developers. This one isn't particularly black, you might notice, but they were black. They're made of these cast iron boxes. They weigh a ton, you know, and they were just the first cut of the things. The things radiated energy, radio frequency energy. It's called RF interference, so badly that, you know, a mile away, people's televisions were going crazy from the stuff. And whenever we got hungry, we'd make, you know, get grilled cheese sandwiches and lay it on top of the box, you know, fry it up for us. But this was it. This was, you know, in effect, this is the second Amiga. The first one we had was at the show. And we mass-produced a bunch of these things, sent them out to a lot of developers. Up here, in this corner, you can see where the ROM chips are. And that's where, as we evolved the operating system, we would, you know, make a new set of ROMs, drop them in, and send out a new set of ROMs to all of our developers. The developers would get new sets of ROMs from us and have nervous breakdowns. Because every time we sent them a new set of ROMs, we were like, oh, well, we changed everything. Sorry, but we had to, you know. We changed everything. Okay, I can cope, you know. That afternoon, Federal Express, wait, we changed everything. Sorry. There are a lot of developers out there who deserve our undying thanks, because the first guys that had software available for the Amiga when the thing was first launched had, you know, fought against incredible odds, because we were evolving the system as our understanding of it came into being, and we were constantly yanking the rug out from under them. And the worst was the ones that we forgot to tell them about, you know. There were a few of those. It stopped working, they call us up, it doesn't work. So, well, you know, what arguments? Oh, you got the arguments wrong, you know. Jerks, yeah. Okay. Down here at the bottom is a keyboard. I got a close-up of that keyboard. Oh, no, wait, sorry. This is the second Amiga. This is another view of it, top-down view. Here's a close-up of the keyboard with the old Amiga logo on it. Too bad that didn't last. I don't know if you can tell well enough from this photograph, but the box itself is made out of wood. Wooden keyboards, metal computers, just like an IBM, you know? cheap shot. Okay. Here, meanwhile, is the first Amiga shell that was ever designed. Here's a slightly better close-up of it. This is mounted on a real nice piece of wood, and over here on this little plaque, it shows better in this other one, on a little plaque here, is it says, to Jay and Michi, the heart and soul of the Amiga. And that's really true. Although, of course, you could have scratched the J part out if you really wanted to. And don't forget, good old Michi, who's still doing okay. Michi's one of my favorite dogs. And you'll notice here in this Amiga, this was the original design. We always had the garage in it. The garage is a place where you stash the keyboard, which you can no longer do on your 2000, which is really a problem for me because I run out of desk space all the time. I love the design of being able to stash it. What this photograph doesn't show is the original design for the garage, the keyboard that we had, where not only could you put the keyboard into the garage, but we had a little electric door opener too that would keep your dust off your keyboard while you're not in use. You'll also notice that there's a second unit on top here. It doesn't show really well. What does show in these units is that these are already 3.5-inch drives. We had changed our mind about the 5.25 and the IBM compatibility. And this second unit here was our original plan for how we were going to do expansion with the Amiga. We're going to have the expansion port, instead of coming out of the side, come straight up the center. And you could then expand on your machine by buying expansion boxes that would plug right down onto the top. And an expansion box itself would have a port that you could plug another one and plug another one so that you could go up instead of out to the side like you're now able to do so. And it was a great design. It's really too bad that we didn't go with that, because that would have been the way to go with this expansion stuff. And unlike the current expansion hardware, the original design was to be able to allow any number of boxes to be stacked up there. And, you know, we had visions of Amiga owners with mile-high Amigas, you know, have all this great stuff in it, but that didn't happen. Do I have more of that one? Yeah, I don't think so. Okay. And, you know, we were making good progress. We were moving along all the while. But unfortunately, we weren't convincing any of the venture capitalists, and we're starting to run out of time. We had all this stuff together, as I said, to get to the second CES show, and we made it there and here in Chicago, and you know, made a really big splash. Everyone was really impressed with it, but still there was no one believed that the world needed another computer. Everyone said, well, you know, Apple's doing well enough. What do you need a new computer for? And the bottom started dropping out. We did really well at the CES, and everyone was still working together. We still had that great passion, that great sense of pulling together as a team to get everything done, but it started to feel in the air as if it was going to go bad, because there was just less and less money all the time. It was getting harder and harder. You know, we knew the kind of debts we had run up with our creditors and the fact that we weren't paying them. You know, at one point a real irate creditor came into the building, and they had to calm the person down, and then the woman that had done that got to wear a fireman's hat for the rest of the day. She was real proud. But we're just losing steam all the time, and not making it, which was really disheartening for us. It was really discouraging, because we, you know, we all believed so much in what we're doing, but I was just running out of time. Let's see. Dale, meanwhile, and I went on a trip. I did it again. Here's me on this trip. It was a show, I think, we went to. Here's Dale on this trip. In between us is Joe Pillow. You guys ever hear of Joe Pillow? You'll find him if you hit Shift-Shift-Alt-Alt-F10 or something like that on your Amigas. The imaginary character that Dale and I cooked up for this flight. And if you can catch us somewhere on the floor today or tomorrow, ask us to tell you the Joe Pillow story. It's a really good one. But, you know, all this good spirit and stuff notwithstanding, it just wasn't doing it. We weren't cutting it. So we finally started to get pretty desperate for cash, and it started to look to us as if we really weren't going to make it. This is now getting into the fall of 1984, and it had been a great effort, but it wasn't going to fly. So what we started to look for instead was someone who would buy the company and allow us to finish the computer. It's just that they would then own the computer when we were done. And we talked with a bunch of people. We talked with, we talked with Sears again. We talked with Sony. We talked with Philips. We talked with Apple. Steve Jobs was down twice, in fact, to see the Amiga and, you know, to get a good look at what we were doing. But none of it panned out. And we were really getting desperate for cash. At this point, we hadn't missed any payrolls. And I don't know how bad it would have been if people hadn't gotten paid. Some people probably would have been too nervous to stick around and started interviewing. Most of us would have held through. But it was getting pretty bad. And it got so bad at one point, in fact, that we weren't going to be able to make one payroll. And the president of the company, Dave Morse, took out a second mortgage on his home so that we could make that payroll. This is the kind of guy he was. Dave Morse, when he would come walking down the corridor back to the software cave, we would all kind of float up off our chairs spontaneously, you know, and there was this glow would start to come through the door as he got close, and you knew Dave Morris was coming. And he was an excellent leader for us, but we saw during these days he couldn't hide the fact from us that, you know, desperation was upon us. And If it was a regular company, you know, who would have cared? Everyone would have quit and gone, got other jobs or something like that. But there was such a passion for what we were creating that it was a real hard thing for us to accept, a real hard thing for us to live with. So then came Atari. And Atari said that they would make a deal to buy the company from us. And they, you know, they knew that we were real tight for cash, so they made a deal with us where they would advance us $500,000 to make our immediate payments. What we owed immediately, there was a payroll they do the next day that this whole thing came down. And then we would have 1 month to negotiate with them to come to a deal for them to buy the Amiga. And you know, the idea or the agreement being that if after 1 month we hadn't been able to come to an agreement, we would cheerfully give them back their $500,000, which $500,000 was gone the very next day. And unfortunately, Atari knew that. They knew what kind of desperate straits we were in because it was, everyone in the industry knew how things were going with us and how badly we were behind in our payments to various people. And so Atari came in and they said, okay, we'll give you $1 a share for your Amiga stock. And we said, $1 a share? God, in our wildest dreams, we had thought $50 a share, you know, $75 a share. We're going to be rich. It's going to be great. God. $1 a share was ridiculously low. So Dave Moore said, you know, $1 a share is ridiculously low. And the Atari guy said, okay, how about 85 cents a share? So wait, at Harvard they told me you go up, I go down, you know. And the truth was that Atari knew the condition that we were in, and Atari was not interested in buying us. Atari was interested, for reasons of its own, in buying just the machine. They didn't want to buy the group, they wanted to just get the technology. And they were interested in just raping and pillaging, taking what they could and letting everything else die. So they didn't care, and they knew we weren't in a position to bargain, so they just continued to bargain in real bad directions, down, for instance, instead of up. And it went from bad to worse. And we watched Dave Morse over that month going through these really hairy negotiations and still trying to explore other avenues and having nothing pan out, nothing come up. And the negotiations with Atari went from bad to worse. And we watched this great fearless leader of ours go from this glowing, shining figure turn into a guy that kind of, you know, drag his way into work with his shoulders caved in and kind of work his way across the floor to his office and go in there and close the door and then at the end of the day open the door and come out and just go home depressed. And it was depressing all of us. We were, in order to cut the deal with Atari, we had to take a copy of the system software and the masks for the chips and put it in escrow so that, you know, if California fell in the ocean or something like this, Atari would at least have something for its $500,000. And we were so interested at this point in stopping the Atari deal from happening, we would rather sink than let Atari get the machine because they were being so bad to us. And we're trying to plot ways to burn Amiga to the ground and destroy all our notes and get into escrow and, you know, pour oil on the tapes or something. Anything, this, you know, to stop Atari, but, you know, it was hopeless. It was all hopeless. And it was, now we're down to the last few days before the end of you know, the end of the agreement, where we either have to come up with the bread for Atari or they would get the company. And then the phone rang and it was Commodore calling, and Commodore said, well, we can make you a much better deal than that, you know. So they send out their plane and Dave Morse hops in the plane and he flies out to Westchester, Pennsylvania, or New York, or wherever it was. And They what follows then are three and a half days of intense negotiations where, you know, they're hammering out one detail after another. What's going to happen? Dave's interested in the people. Oh, this and that and the other thing. And they go back and forth and they're trying to get everything worked out so that, you know, the deals are just right. And and, you know, when you don't cut a deal like this in 3 days without working well into the night. And here it is the last night and these guys, 3 o'clock in the morning, and now what are we going to do? And they're dancing, you know, to keep themselves awake, to keep going here. And it's now it's the last minute, and there's the jets out in the parking lot with its, you know, revved up against its brakes, and, you know, everyone's around the table, and they say to Morris, they say, $4 a share, that's our final offer, you're out of time, you either accept it or, you know, not, and go with the Atari. And he says, I don't know, let me check with my people. He goes, gives Jay a call, he says, $4. Jay says, well, it's not 50, but, you know, it's $4 is okay. If you think it's right, go with it. And he calls up, you know, the other guy's a VP of marketing, the VP of sales. What do you think? Well, you know, it's not what we had in mind, but it's better than zero. I'll go with it. And everyone said, okay. So he went back to the table and he sat down. He said, sorry, my people say $4 is not enough. I'm going to have to decline your offer. They said, well, how about for a quarter? He said, okay. I don't know about you guys, but I would not have the nerve to look down a barrel of a gun like that. So they write him out a check for $500,000. He hops in a jet. He flies back to Atari headquarters. He walks in the front door. The lawyers are big, fat lawyers with their huge cigars. Morse, yeah, good to see you. Come on in. We got some papers for you. He takes that check. He slams it down on the table and says, see you, boys. I got a plane to catch. Yeah. God. Oh. To be a fly in a wall of that office and see those guys' faces when he left the room. So Commodore bought the Amiga, and they bought the group. Their intention was to keep us together as a group, and they, you know, it's a matter of public record. They paid $27.1 million for the company, and not only that, but immediately they opened the cash spigot and inflowed another, I don't know, $8-10 million worth of equipment that we sorely needed. We moved to a new building, you know, it became heaven. And everyone was terrified that Commodore was going to put on its big army boots and come tromping through the company and wreck everything. But nope, right in the very beginning, they left us alone. They replaced Dave Morris with a top guy of their own, but that was the only change. The rest of it, they left us together as a group to do the things that we had set out to do. And it was wonderful. We had all the cash we needed. And they also told us that we could take our time. That, you know, we had put together a machine that we believed was close enough to production to go with. And they said, nah, you don't have to. You know, take your time. Take another length of time. What would you like to do if you had the freedom to make some changes? So, ooh, we'd like to change the keyboard. Oh, we'd like to do this and that to the operating system. And they said, yeah, go ahead. So they gave us a lot of breathing space from the end of 84 until, you know, well into 85 before before they actually launched the machine. And even then, you know, with all the breathing space we had, we still ran out of time. And because, you know, more features, and everything kept growing, and, you know, it was too tight. But still, we did it at least in a cash-rich environment right at first. And then Commodore fell apart. God, when we were bought by Commodore, the stock was worth $26 a share, and it promptly plummeted to 11, where, you know, and then it fell to 8 and 6, and now it's, I guess, hanging around 11 or 12, something like that. But Commodore fell apart. They were in great financial straits at that time, and it just went really bad. And, you know, a lot of cheap shots that people make, like me, at Commodore and their lack of getting the Amiga to marketplace and their lack of marketing and stuff like that, they really are not called for, because Commodore had no cash. They were seriously in debt. They had three quarters in a row where they lost millions and millions of dollars, and they did what they could. But anyway, they kept the team together for a while. Here later on in time, we put together this, which was a photograph of the Amiga group. This was all of us after Commodore bought us, but before the group started to break apart. This is almost all of us. Dale's not in this picture, unfortunately, although he's in a later one that I'll show you. Here I can show you, there's a blow-up of the right side. There's Jay Miner over here and a couple of the bunch of the other people that were from the company. I was doing the slide, and I did a blow-up of the left-hand side here. When I did that, I noticed that there's a guy here in the back who seems to be reading a newspaper. Let us zoom in on him, and yes, indeed, he's reading a newspaper. That's Mike Boom. So I did a photo-enhanced version of the newspaper to see what it says, and it says, two-headed baby, alive and kicking. Yeah, let me show you this again. There he is, back there, reading this paper. What a goof, I swear. And here's another newspaper about the Amiga that you might be interested in. That's an Amiga 1000 there, folks. Here's what they did with the photograph when people started leaving and getting fired. They went in and started doctoring it up and whiting out the people's faces. Here's some of the headlines showing from top to bottom the Amiga and Commodore at their high point and then slowly degrading till it gets down to the lower point where, you know, Commodore expects a loss and sets a layoff. I left before it got fashionable to leave. I stayed around through 85. I became director of software engineering for a while and then stopped doing that so that I could do intuition, and worked like a maniac on intuition for 7 months and then got married. I don't know which one was better. Yes. My wife's not here, is she? No, that's right. Okay. That's right. My wife's home with our new baby. That's right. I left, and when I left, I had a whiteboard in my office. Not a whiteboard, a notepad. Big notepad on a tripod. And I wrote this note on my white pad and stuck it outside my door and left it there. And then, well, it was January of 86, and you know, I went off and started, I became a consultant for Commodore. I started working on my now fabled, never to exist perhaps, Electronic Arts game and, you know, stuff like that, helping a lot of other people with software. The Amiga people, the team stayed together, even though the layoffs started to happen. They started to axe people. Commodore had a big, I think it was a Thursday, Black Thursday or something like this, where they decided if they're going to stay alive as a corporation, they're going to have to fire a lot of people. And then, late in 86, was when the 1.2 release of the system finally came into being. And when that happened, the Amiga team had been kept together by Commodore long enough to get 1.2 done. And then people either left or were fired, and it became the end, finally, really the end of the Amiga group. The story ends. I have a couple of things to note about the whole thing. First of all, don't try to sell your company to Atari. And second of all, I'm really glad that it happened, not only for me, but for all of you. This is the end. This is the last time I'm going to tell this story, and I'm really glad to be able to tell it with you guys. I'm really glad to be able to share it with you. Even saying these words is giving me goosebumps up here because it's been a lot of fun, and I'm really glad to, you know, have this time with you. And so, you know, I may be dropping out of sight here.